On our minds this week, Valentine's Day is coming up, and we're working on a show for next week about the new science and math of relationships. So to get in the mood, here's Christian Rutter. He's the founder of OkCupid, and he thinks love is all about algorithms. Sarah Nix has been reading his book, Dataclism, in which he talks about why he wanted to crunch the love numbers.
Oh, yeah, I think you'd have to be a stone not to become curious after a while with all this stuff. I mean, you know, the data of just running the business of OkCupid involves who likes who hates who, people that want to sleep together, people that can't stand each other, how people describe themselves. I mean, all of these kind of fundamental questions about people or fundamental processes of life happen through the site. And so, you know, you're trying to make an interface so that people can do all these things, and you have to think about the behavior a little bit more in the abstract in order to do that. And yeah, the more you see of it, the more curious you get, for sure.
And for this book, you got access to behavioral data from other big sites too. What else did you use?
I generated my own sort of randomized set of people on Twitter and their tweets to research questions about how people write on Twitter. I have some data from a job site called ShiftGig. I did a lot of exploration in Google Trends and Google Books, which is kind of their collection of all the written work they've been able to get their hands on that you can search as if it were online. But also, I've been writing about OkCupid's data for about 5 years, but people at Google and people at Facebook have more intimate access to that data than I do. And there's other people doing work like that at Google and Facebook who are looking at the human side of their data and publishing what they've discovered. And so I wrote the book to look at their stuff, look at my stuff, and sort of tie it all together in a sort of state of the world as far as what data can tell.
And what are some of the most surprising things you've run across?
Well, there's a funny irony in big data that I've discussed with other people who do similar work to me. The more time you spend with it, the more it just kind of confirms your cynical intuition about people. But I think in terms of things that did surprise me a little bit, I think the writing on Twitter is actually way more sophisticated than you'd think. When you get down and you analyze the syntax, you analyze the words people choose, it's actually in some ways more robust than, say, magazine-level journalism. Another thing, this is a little bit of a kind of a weird fact for the book, but some researchers from the UK using Facebook like patterns and like patterns alone, so no photos, no friend networks, none of that stuff. From just like patterns, they could predict your race with 95% accuracy, your sexuality with 88% accuracy, your gender with 85%, all the way down to with 60% accuracy, they could tell if your parents got divorced before you were 21, which is like, that's not even like a demographic detail. That's like a biographical fact of something that happened to you in your past. It's remarkable that you can tell that just from people liking books and movies and articles and stuff.
And in the book, you don't just look at patterns of who's attracted to whom and why. Well, one of the chapters that I found most intriguing was the chapter on race.
Oh, yeah.
Could you just kind of do a thumbnail sketch of what you found about racial preferences or prejudices?
I viewed race through two lenses. One is through dating sites, not just OkCupid, but also other sites on our portfolio that are totally different. And I looked at who's hitting on who, basically, or who finds who attractive. And through across all the sites, back through time, the same pattern occurs. Black men and black women are underappreciated, as are Asian men. And this is basically, it's as if somebody has stamped it. It's that consistent, it's that repetitive, has stamped it across all these data sets.
Well, and this leads to a kind of overarching question that I have. And, you know, what I'm wondering is, there's something different about what we do during those private moments with the internet and how we interact with the world in person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people reading about your research and your findings see it as a sign of our hypocrisy. But I think that there's a more nuanced way to look at that somehow.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I think it does show a lot of people's hypocrisy, for sure. I mean, you know, and who isn't a hypocrite, really, you know? But also, it's an interesting thing. I've thought about this a lot, this discrepancy, or people are just willing to, like, unleash their id, you know, online, especially when they're anonymous, as you basically are when you're searching for things. Mm-hmm. And it's weird that id is so much more of such an uglier creature than people out in the real world, you know? And in a kind of counterintuitive way, it actually speaks to the value of society. Like, it is in some ways comforting that the fact we have kind of all agreed together to suppress these kind of horrible things. If people acted on the street like they acted on Google, it would be a rough world, you know, or on Reddit. It would be a terrible world. But when we're interacting with people in person, there's norms, there's etiquette, there's taboos, and like, it shows that those things actually have value. I mean, obviously norms can be oppressive for sure, but it means that the fact that the two things are different, our public and our sort of more private or intimate, it shows that, like, fundamentally we do actually care about being acceptable people, you know, en masse, you know? And I think in a kind of a counterintuitive way, I think it's that is an encouraging thing to see. And so, I don't know. It's a nuanced thing. I mean, human psychology, human behavior are infinitely complex, obviously.
And in this kind of exploration of prejudice or, you know, kind of non-socially acceptable thoughts, there is a way, this kind of interesting side argument that you present about how what we do and see in those quote-unquote private moments online can become the real world a little bit. I'm thinking particularly about the Google autocomplete research that you did. Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. I read a paper that looked at Google's autocomplete feature and its ability not just to reflect stereotypes, but to actually promote them out there in the world and push them out. Because I know when you, if you type, you know, why do gay people, and then you leave it hanging, Google will suggest some possible answers, and it will suggest them according to what is most popular out there. So, you know, and it'll say, why do gay people look alike? I wasn't even aware that was a stereotype for gay couples, I guess, or why do gay couples look alike? And it's just, it's strange to think that the fact that things have been entered into the database, so to speak, means that they're there to be reflected back out to us and then adopted in some ways. And you get this kind of feedback loop, but to a negative end. You know?
Right, because the experience could be I'm typing in why do gay something, who knows what I'm typing in, and then it says couples look alike, and I see that. I think, oh, is that a thing? I didn't know that was a thing. I should probably know if that's a thing. So I go and I choose the autocomplete suggestion, and suddenly I'm faced with a world of stereotype to dig through.
Exactly. It's you know, Google has this big brother vibe sometimes, but this is it being kind of more older brother, like teaching you, you know, it's racist jokes. Basically, it's teaching you bad things. It's teaching you stereotypes about people in a way that you didn't know before. So you're like the, you know, the 12-year-old talking to the jaded 15-year-old here.
Most of the data that you've had access to is relatively young, you know, compared to kind of traditional longitudinal behavioral studies, right? It covers, you know, the last 6 or 7 years. But what potential do you think is out there for big data sets as they grow over time to show us about how our society is changing?
Well, I mean, even just to pick up this Google example here, you know, I mean, Google's been reporting this stuff on Google Trends for 10 years, since 2004. And imagine that's a blink of an eye in a kind of historical time frame. But imagine it going 50 more years, and who knows where searches for the N-word are going to be. You know what I mean? Like, it could be down to zero. And what would that say about our society? I think it would be a tremendously encouraging, just for example. You know, and it's a thing that you couldn't measure via a survey over that amount of time. I think the cultural implications of the fact that people are liking all the stuff on Facebook, and they're going to like different things in 5 years, they're going to like different things in 10 years. And you can, you know, take the temperature of people's attitudes, again, in a way that a survey is never going to be able to address.
You know, you mentioned when we first started talking that some of the things that you've come to discover through your research have reinforced some cynicism that you have about human nature. And I wonder if you will have kind of human study fatigue at some point. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely possible. Yes, it's possible. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love learning, and I love writing about this stuff, and I especially love thinking about this stuff. But, you know, like, working for a dating site will it grows you up quick, let me put it that way. You see some crazy things. But, you know, I mean, I love it. And I guess in the book especially, I try to have a sense of humor about the whole thing. You know, I mean, we're talking about big issues, even you and I right here, and we're talking about possible futures and all of these highly meaningful things. But, you know, I also, you know, it's the internet, and I personally like to approach anything with a sense of humor, and I try to put that in the book. That's what keeps me going through all this stuff, is the possibility that there might be a good joke at the end of some of it.
Christian Rutter is the founder of OkCupid. It's one of the world's largest dating sites. He's also the author of Dataclism. Sarah next talked with him.